This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Off and on this morning, and for the past few days, been in some considerable pain from something in my back. Or anyway, that's what it feels like. And Zen is kind of infamous for the way that it asks students of the way to put themselves in kind of uncomfortable positions. If our sitting time, if that's what we do, is relatively limited, we may not notice that so much. But as the period of immobility extends, there can be considerable discomfort. And we've talked many times about how some of that discomfort you should take care of. You should find a more balanced posture, or if you're stressing some, you know, your knee joints or something, try to adjust that. But some of that discomfort is what you might call existential, and you can't get away from. You might say there's the, what do we call it, the sort of coarse experience of pain, which is familiar to everyone, and then kind of riding right underneath that is a more subtle experience based on what pain is telling us about our human condition. And depending how you look at it, that might not be good news. As everybody knows, the fundamental attachment is to this body, mind, this person. And part of the message of our pain and discomfort of whatever kind is that there is no way to be successfully attached to this person. And if you don't mind my teasing you guys a little bit, why is that? Why is it that
it's impermanent for one?
What's impermanent?
Disattachment.
Forgive me if I'm pressing you to be a little more precise. If you're saying the attachment is impermanent, well,
the body mind.
Ah, so the person,
yeah,
the object of the attachment can't be grasped. So this is a guaranteed recipe for suffering, as Buddha very, very clearly explained. One of the five skandhas, as again, I'm sure you're aware, is called the aggregate of samskaras. And in the Buddhist context, samskara is sometimes it's translated as an emotional tendency or vector. So the samskara skandha basically includes what we usually think of as feelings. And even though people sometimes translate the second skandha, vedana, as feelings, that's actually misleading. Vedana is sensation. Feelings, as we normally think of them, belong with the samskara skandha. And in our experience of discomfort, the samskara skandha tends to be activated. We have lots of feelings about our body and how we would like it to be, and maybe the emergent reality is something different from what we would order if we could. And that's, in fact, one way of speaking of the human condition. Because the human condition is that no matter the vigor of our attachment to the person will pass away. And our sense of comfort and balance, from some traditional points of view, is a very temporary, happy balance of various energies. Physical, mental health is a fortunate occurrence, and again is also, it can't be compelled. So probably the main energy that comes from the samskara skandha when we are not so comfortable is to move away from that. And there are all kinds of more or less successful methods for doing that. And basically, pretty much all of those methods we set aside when we come to practice our sitting in stillness. So then sometimes you really feel the power of that, the samskara skandha, urging us to move away from whatever the unpleasantness is. And when the unpleasantness is in your very body, such as this pain I'm having, it's an extremely good laboratory for studying that process. Watching the effect on the body-mind of kind of going with the energy of that samskara skandha and trying to get away from whatever's bothering us. So that's the natural course of things, you might say. And the natural mechanism of suffering. Because to respond in the usual, habitual way to that energy will obscure the fact that this person cannot be grasped. The realization of that is what in Buddha Dharma is called liberation. To see and understand and make real the inescapable fact that the person cannot be grasped. So there, you might say, there isn't any, there's no wiggle room there. Either the person is a graspable entity, or it isn't. There's no in between. And this no in between is actually where we practice. So one way that that has been expressed in times past, a famous Tang Dynasty master, Fa Yun, who is the progenitor of one of the five houses of Chan or Zen, asked his Dharma brother, Xushan was his Dharma brother. They were both students of the great Ditsang, another Tang Dynasty dynamo. So he asks his Dharma brother, he says, this is a very, very famous quote, "A hair's breadth difference is as the distance from heaven to earth." "How do you understand?" he asks his Dharma brother. His Dharma brother, Xushan, replies, "A hair's breadth difference is as the distance from heaven to earth." And Fa Yin won't let him go with that, so he says, "How can you get it that way?" And as Xushan says, "Well, I'm just like this. What is your thinking, teacher?" And Fa Yin says, "A hair's breadth difference is as the distance from heaven to earth." And Xushan wakes up. So one way of looking at our practice is studying what is this hair's breadth difference. Again, there isn't, you know, really, there isn't even the width of a hair of wiggle room. This body-mind is ceaselessly and constantly manifesting impermanence, as is every other phenomenon of existence. And to, vow ourselves to the ceaseless contemplation of that reality means to walk the paths of the path of the Buddhas. So this is one reason why we engage in what on one level looks like the complete absurdity of sitting down somewhere and getting really uncomfortable and continuing to sit there. It's like, well, that's just stupid. Except that it actually allows us to manifest the truth of the ungraspable person in a way that is actually transformative. Now, even if we accept that completely, the likelihood that we will suddenly, completely, and instantly stop trying to edge away from the ungraspableness of the person is not just going to disappear overnight. So we will have many opportunities to study the energy of escape, you might say, the energy devoted to looking for that hair's breadth difference through which we can escape. And yet here are our teachers saying, sorry, there is no loophole. And the cultivation of loopholes is the cultivation of suffering. So the good news is there actually is no hair's breadth difference. And should the mind give rise to the illusion of such a difference, this teaching is present in order to remind us of the path of practice, which is the path away from suffering for ourselves and all beings. So this kind of study is quite subtle, actually. And I think for probably most people, maybe everybody, the experience of practice is one of increasing subtlety as we notice with greater and greater refinement what is actually happening. And to continue with that kind of effort means that we become increasingly able to use the energy of discomfort to reveal the truth, instead of constantly trying to escape. If you're like me, you will probably continue to rely on artificial settings where you get together with other people and practice kind of being still. Of course, you can do that anywhere. Okay? And the more you practice, the more it will become obvious that you can do that anywhere. Standing in line, riding the bus, even lying down for a nap. But it probably will be helpful in order to establish the mind of practice, the vow of practice. It'll be helpful to join with others in this cultivation of stillness. Our great ancestor, Tiantong Hongzhe, who's monastery I was honored to visit last month in China. He collected these stories, including the one that I just mentioned, and he wrote a little poem. And he says, if even a butterfly lands on the balance scale, it tilts. So, this is a poetic evocation of the subtlety of our efforts to escape. This karmically rooted, karmically generated energy constantly moving away from the inevitable truth of the ungraspable person. Even a butterfly landing, the scale will tilt. He says, the balance scale of myriad eons exposes unevenness. So, what is the balance scale of myriad eons? Well, one way to talk about it is sitting in stillness. You could say samadhi, to use another technical term, again, as with so many other things in Buddhism, there are plenty of argument about what that word even means. There are countless, supposedly, specific samadhis, but there's also the samadhi of every day, you might say, the samadhi of all the time, the samadhi accessible moment after moment after moment. That's the place of not even a hair's breadth difference. And like it or not, that's actually where we live. There is no other place to live. And that's really kind of wonderful. Because you don't have to go somewhere to find your place of practice. It's where you live. And to make that our home over and over and over again, moment after moment after moment, is that's the balance scale of myriad eons. So I ever since I was a little kid, I'm not sure why, but I've had the kind of habitual frame of mind where I'm always waiting for the axe to fall. One of my many hapless therapists suggested that it was probably because when I was 2.5, I had my appendix out in what was thought to be an emergency and turned out not to be at all. But because it was thought to be an emergency, it was like, okay, bring him in, we're going to do surgery right away. And this was like 1953.5 or something. It's like, medically speaking, that might as well be the Dark Ages. So I had had a cold, and at the time, they didn't want to use general anesthesia on someone who, you know, especially a kid who'd had some respiratory trouble. So they gave me a spinal anesthetic, which meant I was awake for the operation and numb from the neck down and obviously, you know, clueless as to what was going on. So this may be the source of the sense that I always had that the axe is about to fall. So this particular pain in my back, it's just like, okay, this is the latest. Okay, here it comes. Here comes the axe. This is some kind of cancer or, you know, some catastrophe that's about to land on my head. And I am very grateful to Buddha Dharma for showing me how to practice with that, that it's possible to practice with that. In that uncomfortable space of like, here it comes. Here comes the axe. To manifest the absence of the hair's breadth difference, to allow it to manifest. You don't have to do anything. That's how things are. So this is the meaning of taking the seat over and over and over again. And one of these times, yes, the axe is going to fall. Absolutely. No exceptions. Same for everyone. So that means all of us have this opportunity. Sometimes the axe falls very fast, and, you know, a piano lands on your head. And then you don't have much time to, you know, appreciate that space, but who knows what happens then? There may be a sudden disruption, and there you are floating over a piano on the side. What the hell happened? Maybe there's an opportunity there, too. We will see. For Buddhists, of course, it's like, this is no big deal. Right? We have as many lives to look forward to as the length of time it will take to save all beings. This is the Bodhisattva vow. So one life, more or less, So I'm once again recommending this practice of no hair's breadth difference. And you know, it's quite up to you how you want to do that or not, if you don't want to. One way is silent sitting, and there are also many other ways. Hunger also says, what does he say? Pounds and ounces, grams and kilograms, you see them clearly. But finally, it all reverts back. And nothing, says he, can resist my 0 point. The 0 point is that place. No difference. No gap. And again, this is not something you do. This is how you are now. My intention is that before the axe falls, I will have an opportunity to clean up my room and get rid of a bunch of junk so that someone else doesn't have to do that. But if it doesn't work out that way, I really apologize. I shudder to think what's under my bed at this very minute. Have any question?
Yeah. Thank you for your talk. A friend recently remarked that her recent lunch companion had spent the whole time talking about her health. Mm-hmm. And I recently had a health issue, as you know. Mm-hmm. And also, I recently had news that a friend, a contemporary, had developed a rapid case of Alzheimer's. And so I'm wondering about this teaching and how I can reset my thinking when there's this preponderance of aging-related issues that mm-hmm. keep presenting themselves as kind of stirring things up.
Yeah. Well, there isn't any reset necessary. To, in a manner of speaking, just to think of the path is enough. That realigns the karmic effort again. Now, if in addition our, I don't know, experience of practice is such that trusting this no difference is easy for us, that's very beneficial. I kind of feel like my, through the kindness of my teachers, I have been able to, that trust has been able to develop. I also sometimes look to my teachers and others for whom that trust is a reality, and that re-encourages me in that practice. So I would just say, make a practice, and I say this to myself too, of total trust in that no difference. And that's, again, that is not, that is, there's no knack to it. There's no skill. It's how we are. So to return to that over and over again means a lot of unnecessary stuff falls away, even in the midst of a lot of stirring things like bad news about other people or about ourselves. It can just fall away. Which is, you could say, that's the upside of impermanence. Nothing can stay. Nothing can stay still. And the mind, the heart of no difference, of nothing can stay still, is permanently, pardon the expression, present for all of us. It's how we are. So to trust that completely is a lifetime's practice. Can't think of a better one myself. And it's true, you know, I'll be 66 next month, and the news of impermanence comes more and more often and more inexorably. So I think I thank my lucky stars for practice. The way to, you might say, use the bad news, the way it's usable. Or one way it's usable. Yes?
You mentioned there are other ways of building practice other than sitting. What have been some ways that were very effective for you?
Well, in a sense, it's all just sitting, right? So the question is, how many different circumstances, under how many different circumstances can I manifest the heart of practice, or can I allow the heart of practice to manifest? And the circumstances are limitless. So you can be sitting at your desk, you can be riding in a car, you can even be watching TV, you could be reading a book, and the mind of practice can manifest itself. If one has taken on some of the accoutrements of a practice life, you know, precepts and so forth, sometimes that can help as reminders. One can have Buddhist decorations around the house to remind us. One can wear beads. And all of these are just reminders of our birthright, reminders of no difference. That's the heart of it, not the physical posture or the environment. And the more that one comes to trust that, the more that one will see that that's true. As Dogen calls it, practice verification. Practice is verified in the doing of it, not in arriving at some plateau. He made that very clear. So his expression, practice verification, just those two Chinese characters, is a very, very powerful teaching. Still, there's all kinds of things, you know, one can do. Chanting, prayer, contemplating the sunset, contemplating great works of art. You know, all of these can be a place of practice. Because we bring the heart of practice with us wherever we are. Thank you for coming together to manifest the heart of practice this morning. Please take care. Thank you.